This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This is the, you know, the madness of a civilization that thinks that digging up 200 million year old sunshine is effective. 1,000 years from now, ask anyone, will we still be burning up, digging up and burning coal, oil and gas? And the answer is simply no.
In 1880, Thomas Edison patented a system for the distribution of electricity that within 2 years was providing power through a grid to parts of Lower Manhattan. How far have we come since then? According to today's guest, not far enough. This week on Sea Change Radio, we first talk to sustainability consultant Ted Howes, who explains the direction utility companies should be taking to work smarter, not harder, and why this smart grid technology is meeting with some resistance. Then we hear from Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity, one of the solar companies whose Globama campaign successfully advocated for the reinstallation of solar panels on the White House. He talks about the powerful statement that's made when a U.S. president decides to install solar, or in the case of Ronald Reagan, reject it. Today on Sea Change Radio, the future of electricity. Welcome back to Sea Change Radio, sustainability consultant Ted Howes, who's worked extensively in the energy sector. Ted's clients have included the Department of Energy, clean tech startups, as well as utilities. Ted, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Tell us, what is smart grid by definition?
I think the classic way of thinking about the smart grid moniker is probably overused, but one of the comparisons I really like is if you took Alexander Graham Bell and showed him the telephones of today, he would barely recognize his invention. But if you took Edison out to a power plant or saw some transformers or some lines, he would absolutely recognize his inventions. And smart grid is really taking it from where it used to be, which is analog technology, and moving into the realm of digital technology, allowing for better localization of issues, allow renewables to be adopted into the grid. And also, you know, right now, I mean, our grid is an amazingly advanced piece of architecture from the standpoint of it provides us electricity to a very high degree. And yet, if somebody has an outage, the only way a utility finds out about it is if they get a phone call. And so when we start thinking about smart grid, it's a way of taking the grid and updating it using the latest digital technologies to make it more user-friendly, to allow better adoption of renewables, and to make it, in the end, more efficient.
What are some of the more important technological pieces in the smart grid puzzle to be developed over the last couple of decades?
Well, I think the piece that consumers are going to be most familiar with are the smart meters as they roll out smart meters. And currently, the meters aren't very sophisticated. Until the last decade or so, in order to understand how much energy you used, they actually had to have meter readers drive by and stop by your house and read the meter on a monthly basis and then send you your bill. If they wanted to turn on your power or turn it off, they had to send somebody out. Those are all things that you can do remotely with a smart meter. And with that smart meter, you can now start to better understand how you're using your energy. And I think that's going to be the first point of contact between consumers and the smart grid. A lot of the background infrastructure stuff, consumers will never see or experience.
And when they do experience it, how will they know that their grid is a smart grid?
The funny thing is, I think most people won't know that they have a smart grid or not. The first point of contact for them will be the smart meter, but a lot of people don't even know if they've received a smart meter or not. For example, when PG&E was doing some of the installs on the peninsula near in the San Francisco Bay Area, they would leave a door tag behind. And on the door tag, it said, you know, fix a problem, cut a tree, or other. And they'd check the other and said, install smart meter. And that was really the only point of contact that people had with this new technology around the smart grid. And so I think there's a bit of, in some respects, there's been a bit of overpromising by the by the term smart grid when a lot of it, I think, isn't going to be experienced by the consumer. That being said, there are new tools and technologies where people are going to start to see, you know, through their smart meter or through other devices, how much energy they're using at different times of the day, and they'll be able to start controlling that better, which is important because the first sort of indications we're going to see of service changes is you're going to start seeing time of use pricing by utilities, where utilities are going to now charge peak time pricing when energy is the most expensive.
And what are some of the issues slowing down the rollout of smart grid technology?
It's a bit of a challenge from the standpoint of the consumer adoption because people are starting to see that, you know, as they get these new devices, it does a couple of things. One, it gives them better transparency to real-time usage of their energy, and therefore it gives in some respects, a more accurate depiction of how much they're using and how much their electricity costs. But one of the challenges is that in rolling these devices out in places like Bakersfield is there's been a really strong anti-smart meter response.
And what would that stem from?
It stems from a couple of things. One is, I think it really comes down to trust. People trust their utility to provide them electricity at a reasonable price and to provide it 24/7. You know, great uptime, reasonable price. They don't trust their utility to be able to see into their homes and to be able to know how much energy they're using on a moment-by-moment basis. They don't trust their utility to help them save energy. So when the communication around smart grid came to people, the communication was, we will help you save energy through these devices and in turn help you save money. And what happened in places like Bakersfield is once people got the smart meters, some people actually saw their monthly bills go up. And that could be because their prior meter was faulty. It was an older meter. It could be because now they have a different understanding of how much electricity they're using. And there was a big pushback, and it resulted in a class action lawsuit against Pacific Gas and Electric. And that could have been entirely avoided. And in the end, it comes down to a question of service design. If you don't have the trust of the consumers, you have to think about how you want to roll a new service out to them and help sensitize them to why they're getting these devices, what are the advantages, and to really understand those needs rather than rolling it out as a solution to a problem they didn't know they had, which was essentially how it was positioned.
With the implementation of these high-tech smart meters into people's homes, has privacy been an issue?
Privacy is a big issue for individual consumers on this. They are concerned about what can be done with their data. And if that data is opened up to other third parties, what does that mean? Or to the government? And I think there's some concerns around intrusion there. And the California Public Utility Commission has clearly ruled that the data from smart grids ultimately belongs to the consumer. And I think that's an important step. The challenge with that, though, is, you know, I think there's a couple of ways to look at smart grid. One is you can look at it in terms of this as a platform on which you can put a lot of apps. And from those apps, there are a lot of potential benefits. I think a lot of those benefits, though, are going to come from seamless engagement with customers. For example, there's some great work, some great prototypes around smart grid where they've taken something as simple as the cycling of a refrigerator and timed it according to other devices in the home, like AC compressors, air conditioner compressors, and they've managed to save a tremendous amount of energy by just timing those differently, because if those two peaks come together at a peak time, all of a sudden your marginal cost of energy shoots up. But if you can spread those out, there are a lot of benefits to the consumer that the consumer will never see. And one of the biggest benefits to smart grid technology is by flattening those peaks throughout the day, particularly in summertime when air conditioner use is high, it reduces our overall cost of electricity because utilities won't have to build peaker plants. And peaker plants are the most expensive, capital-intensive pieces of equipment a utility owns from the standpoint of they produce electricity at the highest marginal cost per unit of power.
Can you tell us what peaker plants are?
A peaker plant is a piece in the current grid where anytime the demand for power spikes beyond the base load, you need to have plants that can come online quickly to provide that cost, that energy.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with sustainability consultant Ted Howes. Ted, can you give us an example of a city that's on the cutting edge of smart grid technology?
With smart grid overall, there aren't any cities in the United States that have fully deployed smart grid solutions, and that is end-to-end from consumer to generation. The closest one that I've seen is, and it's been an ongoing experiment in Boulder, Colorado, where, you know, with Xcel Energy, which is the utility there, they've rolled out smart grid over the last few years, and the results have been mixed. There's been some pretty illuminating articles over the last year or so talking about the Boulder experiment and how it hasn't been as successful in terms of either adopting renewables or energy efficiency. And it goes to one of the central things, which is, you know, when we talk about human behavior, regardless of their values or viewpoint around energy, human behavior is a difficult thing to guide, to make changes around. We all know how hard it is to make personal decisions, and those decisions such as changing your financial picture or changing your wellness picture, those have a fundamentally egocentric motivator. But when you talk about something around energy, it's a little abstract. And so it's even harder to get people to change behaviors. And so I think when we start to look at these technologies, the technology is only a piece of the challenge. The next part of the challenge is, how do we get people to interact with these technologies? And that's where I think design plays a really important role, is understanding people's needs and designing solutions, interactions, devices, services that meet people's needs in a way that they want them to be met.
What are some of the ones that pop up in your mind as innovative technologies that are going to help work hand in hand as smart grid technology evolves?
People aren't going to look at their energy monitors on a regular basis, and you need to involve a little bit more consideration around the kind of interactions that people want to have around their electricity, which is give them information at the right time that allows them to make different decisions versus overwhelming them with data. What I've seen time and time again in this space is people really aren't that interested in the data, except, you know, extreme users and people who are really motivated around energy or sustainability issues. But most people, they just want the highlights. And so they don't want their information on an hourly basis. They don't want the information on a daily basis. They want information when it's important to them, when they can make decisions and help them make better decisions. So when they start to realize that their air conditioners are aging via their usage compared to others' usage, now there's an opportunity for a utility or another service provider to provide them a rebate to buy a new air conditioner. I also think there's an opportunity to bring in some kind of gaming. There's a company called Opower, which has successfully harnessed competition in people's energy usage. And they've done these very direct mailers where they compare your energy usage to your neighbor's energy usage, and they've managed to achieve reductions of 2-3%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in aggregate, it's a massive amount. And they've really managed to do that through harnessing that competitive mindset and that gaming mindset of people.
Gaming has really taken off in hand with mobile phone devices. Are there any breakthroughs that have been occurring there? I know sometimes you leave on the heat and you leave for a weekend and you're just cursing yourself the entire weekend. It'd be great to be able to get on your phone and just dial it down. Are things like that on the horizon?
There are a lot of companies that are experimenting around that. And I think one of the great things that we'll see from that is we'll finally see a cost reduction around that, as well as a reduced infrastructure set that's required. Some of the historic home automation systems have been really expensive and hard to implement, but you're calling into you're calling to relieve some of the great technology changes that we're seeing. You know, one is having ubiquitous smartphones. I think smartphone usage in the U.S. is going to be over 50% of the users have smartphones for the first time ever, which means people essentially are carrying around a computer. The other thing is we're seeing is better plug level controls, more communicative devices such as thermostats that you now can communicate with your smartphone. And even with, if you don't have a smartphone, if your thermostat can send you a text message saying, hey, you know, I've been on for the last 12 hours and I don't think anybody's home, it gives you a clear indicator that you can turn it down. And I think that kind of tool is just makes a lot of sense. And that's going to happen as a matter of course.
This reminds me of a discussion we had with the Energy Star people, which is run jointly by the Department of Energy and the EPA. It's a great program, but there's a lot of criticisms behind it. One of them is that there's just not enough information on the labels when you're purchasing a refrigerator or a TV that could really give you an apples to apples kind of comparison. When you're in Best Buy and you're checking out the Samsung versus the LG, which one is using more electricity and which one has a lower or a better vampire power rating, for example. And they always say, well, you can go to the website and find that out. But if you're in Best Buy, you're generally not going to be going on your phone and looking that up. Some people may, but not enough, obviously.
Right. Or if you are, you're going to do price comparison shopping versus comparison of energy usage. And I think that there is sort of a habitual component of it. And I think there are a number of ways of getting to that. I think if, you know, Energy Star decided that they were going to put a series of barcodes on the Energy Star label that people could scan with their smartphone, and with each scan, they were entered into a lottery to win an entire suite of home appliances, people would start doing that, and that would become a matter of habit. And as they're scanning those barcodes, it gives them information about the energy usage in their area. And so I think that that's the most powerful thing of all. If I was looking at a washing machine and I could see that this one would cost me $36 a year to run with the average loads in my region versus something that would cost $130, well, cost being equal, I'll go with the cheaper one in terms of the overall energy costs. And I just don't think that information is being given to consumers in a readily accessible way. They're assuming a level of motivation of consumers to look into their energy usage that most consumers just don't have.
My guest is Ted House, sustainability consultant. Ted, are there any grassroots organizations that people can get involved with if they want their utilities to become more efficient? Or is this coming from the supply side and the industry side? Are the utilities the one who are bringing this to a populace and say, we want to raise your rates over the short run, but in the long run, it's going to save everybody a lot of money? Where is the impetus coming for this change?
Well, so far, it's absolutely been a supply side phenomena. Nobody, I don't think, and I think part of the challenge was that, you know, in positioning smart grid as a consumer benefit is, you know, I don't think that's working with consumers because in the end, it's a big supply side benefit. But who's paying for supply side? We are as consumers. And so I don't think it's unimportant to focus on the supply side, but let's be honest about it and say, look, you know, your electricity costs are going up. Everybody agrees that with fuel prices going up, people using more and more electricity, the demand on the grid getting more, the aging infrastructure, your costs are going to go up. And at those peak moments, let's get the pricing right. When you look at the way demand is priced in other industries, if you're buying a seat of a flight on an airline that's in a highly demanded route at a highly demanded time, you will pay more for that seat. But in electricity, at a highly demanded time, in the middle of summer, we're still paying the same per unit cost of electricity that we pay at the lowest moment. If you get the pricing right, that'll really help drive consumer behavior in an appropriate way, meaning it'll reduce our overall demand on the grid and reduce our overall costs. In the short run, though, you really do have to implement all the smart meter technology to help that system work. In the long run, though, it saves us a tremendous amount of money. I think that a lot of the utilities have made a mistake in trying to position this as a consumer benefit in order to sell it to the consumers instead of saying this is an infrastructure benefit that will benefit us all over time.
Sustainability consultant Ted House, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise. Our next guest is Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Danny, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, thanks for having us, Alex.
So Sungevity has been in the news for its role in the campaign to get the Obama administration to put solar panels, which the Carter administration originally had installed and the Reagan administration subsequently dismantled, put back up on the White House. Can you give us a little more background on these efforts?
Yes. So last year in 2010, we ran the Globama campaign, we called it, with a bunch of other solar companies and the Solar Industry Energy Association, to say to the Obamas and the current administration, it would be a great signal for the first family to put solar back on the White House. Because there's this history that kind of has set in people's heads the idea that solar is not right or doesn't quite work yet or something, which is not true. And we wanted to redress that with a big signal from the top at the White House itself. So we ran a petition campaign and some other ways to get the solar community behind this call to action. It was a positive campaign, you know, all about doing the right thing, saving some money for the taxpayer while going solar to provide clean electricity for the first family and sending the signal that this is good technology that creates good work here in America by deploying it at scale. And that we were successful in October last year when the White House announced that they would indeed be doing that sometime in 2011. So wait and see. We'll have to find out about that when it is and so on.
But this has really been a fairly lengthy political process.
That's right. So there was a moment there in 2010 where the delegation came with the original solar modules that had been on the White House that Reagan had taken down. These were hot water systems, the solar hot water modules. And the White House declined at that time to accept those and put them back up. But what they have said, the Secretary of Energy actually made a statement in October that they would put up a solar electric and a solar hot water system in the spring of 2011. So they are saying yes to the whole thing. But, you know, I think the background is the important piece, which is the long-term history of this issue, which is that Jimmy Carter put solar up, those hot water modules, in fact, that Bill and the youth brought down with them. And that was obviously, you know, 30 years ago. And there was this great speech he made about the symbolism and the importance of making this departure to clean energy back in the 70s. What happened was that when Reagan came in, that administration took those panels off the roof. And there was this sort of famous moment where, when asked, one of the administration spokespeople said that this is not a technology befitting a superpower, you know, which is kind of the way in which they really deemed it, you know, impractical for big macho nations like America going forward.
And we're not going to wear a sweater like Carter did in the White House, right?
Right.
We're going to keep our thermostat at 78 if we want to.
And power it with nuclear and all the oil we can burn or whatever the thinking was behind that statement.
So according to a few articles I read, Sungevity, which, full disclosure, is a sponsor of Sea Change Radio, provided some estimates to outfit the White House with solar panels. And this is before the formal bidding process has begun. How did you guys do that?
Right. So that's another piece of the Sungevity solution, is that we don't need to do a site visit to design and engineer your system. We use another new technology, which is kind of exciting stuff, which is the aerial and satellite images we all know from Google Earth and Bing and such, where you can look at a house like the White House and we can actually extract all the factors we need to design and engineer the system using those photographic streams.
You didn't have to get White House clearance.
No, which is pretty cool. So,
and what was the estimate that you thought it would cost for the White House to go solar?
Well, if they were to pay for it up front, it would be somewhere in the range of $100,000. We think that would pay back pretty quickly, like within 5 years, and these systems last for 25 years. So that's a pretty decent return on the investment. The assumptions are about what the electricity cost inside that building is. And we don't know that from looking at it from a satellite image. That's, you know, secret information probably about the electricity consumption of the White House. But you know, we took an assumption modeled on a Californian residence and California rate structures and pretended that that was what they would be paying for electricity. So it's just a good estimate. It was an educational device to present the iQuote to the White House and then put it up on the website solaronthewhitehouse.com and just garner people's awareness of this as a solution. And, you know, it's great to see that the Obama administration has planned to jump on this and do exactly that.
Get me some sun. I'm gonna collect it, baby. And we can have a whole lot of fun. Gonna reflect it, baby. That fossil fuel's got no renewal. You know it couldn't hold a candle.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. My guest is the founder of Sungevity, solar home specialist, Danny Kennedy. Let me read you this quote from David Kreutzer, who's an energy and environmental scholar at the Conservative Heritage Foundation think tank. He says, "It's a strange hark back to the Carter administration. If these are wonderful ideas, you don't need to force people to do it." So what would you say to Mr. Kreutzer?
Well, Mr. Kreutzer is either being, you know, disingenuous or a little bit ignorant of how tax credit subsidies are applied across the energy spectrum, you know, and these sorts of benefits have accrued to the oil, gas, coal, and nuclear industry for a century, basically. By measure, you know, the solar, wind, clean energy industries largely get a fraction of what coal, oil, nukes, and gas get. I mean, I don't have numbers at hand, but say in the five-year period from 2002 through 2007, it was, you know, in the order of a fifth or less compared to what oil, gas, coal, and nukes get. So, you know, like it's a false statement, I guess, to think that it's either or. You know, we're benefiting from incentives. And as to why should the taxpayer do this? Because there are social goods that come out of it. There are public policy requirements. And what, unfortunately, we've been doing for the century that we've been subsidizing fossil fuels is subsidizing the pollution of our children and their health. This is the, you know, the madness of a civilization that thinks that digging up 200 million year old sunshine is effective. 1,000 years from now, ask anyone, will we still be digging up and burning coal, oil, and gas? And the answer is simply no.
Danny, there's more to putting solar panels up in the White House than saving some money for taxpayers.
Well, this is why we were so excited to see the White House moving in this direction last year and for them to announce that they do plan to put solar on the White House. The power of the office can't be understated. You know, you can't take the most famous building on earth, the White House, really, that's probably what it is, certainly the most famous family's home, and do something to it without that signal being heard around the world, you know. And by example, when Michelle Obama planted an organic garden, you know, seed sales went up something like 30% around the country because of the interest in organic gardens and home gardens and victory gardens, as they called them.
But they didn't really need those vegetables in the White House, right?
You know, this is the power of the office, that they can symbolize change. And, you know, just as voting in the Obamas in the first place was a significant step in the evolution of America and you know, the dynamism of America, I think putting solar on the White House to serve the first family with clean electricity for less and create jobs for kids that will put those systems on the roof is a really important development.
Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity, thanks for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by James Brown, Van Morrison, and Little Village. SeaChange Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.